Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If so, congratulations, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have tons of cool features like curated podcast playlists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but my brand new, members-only version of this show, called Morbidology Plus, is only available on the Himalaya app. When you become a member of Morbidology Plus, you'll get all ad-free, exclusive episodes where I'll be covering topics we normally leave out on my free episodes. You'll even get these episodes a full 4 days early. And the best part is, Morbidology Plus is available for just $4.99 a month. For all those reasons, Himalaya is the only listening app that I use, and I'm sure it'll be the only one for you too. So download Himalaya and go join Morbidology Plus today. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Bermuda is a British dependent territory in the North Atlantic Ocean, just around 590 miles off the United States coast. It isn't a third world country or a struggling developing nation. It has one of the highest per capita incomes in the world. In 1996, it had a population of around 60,000 and prided itself on its low crime rate, white sandy beaches and golf courses. Because of this, Bermuda was a widely popular and trouble-free resort, especially popular among Americans. On average, 500,000 people visit Bermuda yearly. Bermuda was also home to a number of expatriates, many of whom come from British Commonwealth countries, and they were attracted to the island because it is steeped in British traditions. With such a small population and low crime rate, island news seldom ventured beyond local newspapers or travel news. That was, at least, until summer of 1996, when the world was rocked by the brutal murder of a young tourist, and the injustice that ensued left a black cloud hovering over this idyllic English colony. Rebecca Middleton was a 17-year-old girl from Belleville, Canada. In June of 1996, she finished grade 11 at Centennial School, where she worked tremendously hard to achieve good grades. She was the youngest child of David and Cindy Middleton, who had separated when Rebecca was 13 years old. Rebecca was just your average teenager. She loved music and hanging out with her friends. A very active teenager, Rebecca enjoyed water sports, including sailing and boating.
Becky was very sociable. She had a lot of friends. And our house with our three kids, our house was full of kids all the time. And Becky was usually in the center.
I didn't worry about Becky. Becky knew the score. She was very savvy. She could have fun too, but she knew where to draw the line.
On the 20th of June, 1996, Rebecca and her longtime friend, Jasmine Means, flew out to Bermuda for a six-week vacation after finishing their school year.
We were really excited. I was counting the days down.
Of course, you always have apprehensions when your child's going somewhere so far away. It's not that you can just drive to Bermuda, you know, if they have a problem.
While David and Cindy had worried about the vacation, like all parents would, they always encouraged their children to enjoy life and make the best of it. Quote, "We raised our kids to be independent and to be part of life," said David. They reasoned that there was very little to worry about, however. Bermuda was a safe place, and Jasmine's father, Ricky Means, lived out there on the main island and was allowing the girls to stay with him. This was a once-in-a-lifetime trip, and for 2 weeks, Rebecca did enjoy herself and her trip. How could she not? Bermuda is a beautiful and idyllic island surrounded by crystal clear ocean, ready to be explored, and fronted by white sandy beaches, ready to sunbathe on. In the early morning hours of the 2nd of July, 1996, Rebecca and Jasmine arranged to meet their friends at a local pub. Rick dropped the teenagers off an hour early, so they decided to do some window shopping before meeting back at the pub. A night of fun followed, including several beers and 2 shooters. Following the pub, the girls went back to their friend Jonathan's house in the tiny town of St. George's, just east of Main Island. The girls' curfew came and went, and at around 1:08 a.m, Jasmine called a taxi to take the girls back home.
I didn't want to get in trouble. I didn't want him to be mad that we were out having drinks.
Despite the fact that they had missed curfew, Rick wasn't worried. It wasn't completely out of character for a teenager to miss their curfew. When the taxi never arrived, Jasmine called back again at 1:45 a.m. and then again at 2:16 a.m. By this point, rain was pummeling down and the girls were becoming agitated. Seemingly, no taxi was coming for them. As they stood drenched, they were relieved when 3 young men on motorcycles stopped and offered them a lift back. Rebecca and Jasmine agreed. Jasmine hopped on the back of 1 motorcycle, while Rebecca sandwiched herself between the 2 men on the second. After they left the main road, Rebecca and Jasmine became separated when Rebecca's motorcycle turned down a dirt track. One of the men brought Jasmine back to her father's home at around 2:30 a.m, but Rebecca never arrived back home.
When we got back to the house, I waited a little bit. And she didn't show up.
Quote, "When Jasmine got home, she was hysterical," said Jasmine's stepmother, Lynn Means. Jasmine woke her father up and the duo searched the streets, calling out Rebecca's name. Their minds were overtaken by all of the horrible thoughts of what could have happened. But then again, Bermuda was safe. Maybe Rebecca just went for a drink with the 2 men, or they simply got lost.
I got very concerned. And then Jasmine and I went looking for Becky.
And he asked me where I last saw her, and I said, the bridge.
It was around 30 minutes later when 4 men who were driving along Ferry Road near the car park of a large seaside nature reserve in St. George, located in northeast Bermuda, stumbled across the body of a young woman. She was partially nude and bleeding profusely. Quote, "It appeared she had crawled onto the road after being attacked and was still breathing," said Dana Rollins, one of the men.
First thought it was a dog, but as I got closer, I realized it wasn't. I saw a young lady laying in the road, fetal position, with her back towards my car. I just walked up very slowly towards her because obviously something had happened to her. And I wasn't sure if the people were still around or what was going on. And as I got closer and looked at her, I could see that there was blood. She was still alive. She couldn't talk because her throat was cut. But I knew she was trying to communicate with me. I can see her moving her lips, but nothing was coming out. I told her, don't talk, just hang in there. She started to cry a bit. So I just used my hand and put pressure on her neck to stop the bleeding and just was waiting for the emergency vehicles to show up. I just kept talking to her, constantly telling her, hang in there, help is on the way. Just stay with me. I am not going to leave you.
They drove to a nearby payphone where they called local police before rushing back to the injured woman. However, by the time they arrived back, she was dead. The first officer to arrive at the scene was Sergeant Charmaine Marcus, an 18-year veteran of the Bermuda Force. Quote, "She was a beautiful, innocent kid. There was nothing I could do. She didn't have a pulse." The 4 men who found Rebecca's body were questioned and quickly ruled out as suspects. They were questioned as to why one of the men didn't stay with Rebecca while the others went to get help. They replied that they were too scared and worried that a murderer may have been in the area. Police initially refused to release Rebecca's cause of death, but said that they were investigating it as a homicide. One of the men who found Rebecca's body said that she had been stabbed in the chest. An autopsy would determine that Rebecca had been raped, and afterwards her throat had been slit, and she had been stabbed numerous times. She died from shock and hemorrhage. While police had attempted to keep information out of the media, one source close to the investigation told the Toronto Sun that Rebecca had been gang raped. David and Cindy recollect the moment they were told that their daughter was killed.
Becky's dead. Like, oh no, she can't be dead. I didn't want to believe it. It was such a shock.
I got a phone call from my father-in-law, ex-father-in-law, and he says, I got to tell you something. It's going to be tough. We've just been notified that Becky has died in Bermuda.
In my heart, I knew she was dead. I knew that. But you didn't want to believe it, and I just wanted to talk to someone, and I wanted to be there.
The conversation went dead. Nothing. For like at least a minute, which seemed like hours. And I think after that, I didn't really know what I was saying or doing. It was like blackout time.
The tragic news reverberated in Belleville, a town of just 38,000, as they had just been trying to come to terms with the murder of 18-year-old Mark Fike, who had also been murdered while on vacation. However, Mark was in Daytona Beach, Florida, when he was shot during a botched robbery carried out by a gang of kids. Quote, "I just couldn't believe that this had happened again. I know what they must be going through," said Mark's mother, Christine. Quote, "It's absolutely shocking and tragic. It's such a heinous and brutal crime, you don't expect this sort of thing in Bermuda," said Bermuda's premier, David Saul. It was Bermuda's second murder of the year, and the first murder of a tourist since 1992, when a 27-year-old German schoolteacher was strangled to death by a prisoner on an unsupervised work release program. Next, we will hear from Colin Coxall, Bermuda's police commissioner.
Rebecca Middleton's case represents a horrendous murder. I mean, on a 1 to 10 scale, that is up amongst the 10s. And we agreed that the most senior detective on the island would actually run the murder. It's very important indeed for Bermuda to project itself as being crime-free, to attract the American tourists. They do not like information in relation to crimes to be spread abroad at all. They find that very embarrassing.
Rebecca's parents, David and Cindy, flew out to the island to make arrangements for Rebecca's body to be returned home. Speaking of the two men who gave Rebecca a lift, David said, quote, "They were two guys that maybe they didn't know well enough." During a press conference, David and Cindy appealed for the public's help in identifying their daughter's killer or killers. They pleaded that if Rebecca was anybody else's daughter, they would want help too. Quote, "Just think if it was your child or your husband or wife. If you have some information, give it. We want this thing to be solved," said Cindy. A team of 12 detectives were assigned to work on the case. Their first point of investigation was to identify the three men with the motorcycles who had picked Rebecca and Jasmine up. Detective Superintendent Vic Richmond asked the public to keep an eye out for three black men with motorcycles. The murder didn't come as much of a surprise to Kim Ingman, who lived just several hundred metres away from where Rebecca's body was found. He said that searching for young, naive white girls is something that some of the black men who live in Ferry Point Park do on a regular basis. Quote, "They would never do that to a black girl. She would punch the piss out of them and they know it," he said. He said that while murder wasn't common in Bermuda, rape was common in the secluded area where he lived. 2 days after Rebecca's body was found, her parents brought her back to Canada. They were whisked out of a side door at the Pearson International Airport to avoid the awaiting media that had congregated outside of the airport. Back at his home north of Belleville, David said that his trip had been emotional, but said that police in Bermuda were very cooperative and working their hardest to solve the murder. Quote, "The hardest part was not knowing what had happened to our Becky. Now that we have Becky home and we have some of the details from police, it's a little easier. It's very difficult, though, to bring any family member home like this," he said. DNA samples from Rebecca's body were flown to RCMP labs in Ottawa. Semen had been found during Rebecca's autopsy, and Bermuda police were calling on Canadian forensics experts to help analyse them. By this point, police had already found one man out of the three, the one who took Jasmine home. He had already been ruled out as a suspect. Police were still trying to track down the two other men. A source close to police said that they already had a good idea of who the two men were, but said that they were still trying to find them. Quote, "We're hoping to have the case wrapped up by Monday," he said to the Hamilton Spectator. Meanwhile, a shrine of flowers and cards were placed at the scene where Rebecca was killed. The blood-stained ground was a grim reminder of what had taken place there. One card was from Jasmine, and it read, quote, "You are my best friend, and you always will be. I will never forget you, ever. You were a bright girl and a happy girl. When I look at the stars, I know you are looking down on us all. P.S. I'm sorry." On the back of the card was a message from Rick, Jasmine's father. It read, quote, "Although we only knew each other for less than 2 weeks, I am so glad to have met you here on Earth and look forward to seeing you again in heaven. I love you, Becky."
They are nothing short of animals to have tortured and beat that child and left her to die in the middle of the road. They're animals.
Shortly after Rebecca was murdered, there was a third murder in Bermuda, which averaged around 3 murders per year. A local man was shot dead during a possible drug-related incident. The shocking and senseless murder of Rebecca put the small island on edge and made some realize that even in paradise, tragedy can strike. Quote, "I don't like what I see in Bermuda anymore. I see drugs, crime, stabbings, rape, and prostitution," said Sparky Lightbourne, a native of Bermuda and a tour guide for the past 35 years. On the 7th of July, rumors began to circulate that 2 men had been arrested in connection with Rebecca's murder. Apparently, they had been arrested in Somerset, a town at the other end of the island, around 30 kilometers away from where Rebecca was killed. However, Bermuda Sergeant Chris Wilcox said that they could not confirm or deny the report. 2 days later, Rebecca's funeral was held in Bridge Street United Church, Belleville. Bermuda's premier had 2 ambassadors among the mourners, representing Bermuda's government and police force. Around 1,000 mourners packed into the church to pay their final respects to Rebecca. Her father, David, shook hands and greeted most of the mourners. Rebecca's friends clutched each other close and wept throughout the hour-long service. Her cloth-draped coffin had a pink floor on top, alongside a photograph of Rebecca smiling.
All kinds of people came. It was just an outpouring of love from all our friends and everybody. The church was overflowing at the seams. Told her we loved her and we missed her, but I knew she wasn't there. I mean, her body was there, but that was just her shell. So we loved her.
Reverend Hal Wilson urged the mourners to not give up the fond memories of Rebecca because these memories kept Rebecca alive. Quote, "She was one of those people who every day down the hall at school smiled at every single person. I've never been so mad in my life that something like this could happen to such a sweet, innocent girl. We shouldn't be here for this," said one of Rebecca's friends.
Seeing the hearse pull away from the church, that was when I finally came to the realization that I wasn't going to see Becky again.
Around the same time, Bermuda police announced a $10,000 reward for any information that could lead to the arrest and conviction of her killers. Apparently, the earlier 2 men who were arrested in connection with a robbery, not the murder of Rebecca. By this point in the investigation, 14 possible suspects had been questioned, and Assistant Commissioner Harold Monis said, quote, "It is possible that we have had them in." While Bermuda police were holding their cards close to their chest, 21-year-old Perry Mosley Puckerin told the Toronto Sun that he was one of the 14 who were questioned. Perry said he had been questioned by police and taken to the hospital to provide a blood sample. Perry had once been arrested for assault, and when he was picked up for questioning, he had a black eye and cuts on his hand. Quote, "I didn't do it. I wouldn't touch a white girl," he told the Toronto Sun. Furthermore, Perry had an alibi for the night of the murder. He had been playing soccer with his cousin before going to his aunt's house for the night. The very next day, it was announced that 2 men were picked up for questioning. News reports in Bermuda said that a 17-year-old and a 21-year-old from Pembroke Parish in central Bermuda had been arrested in connection with Rebecca's murder. Bermuda police confirmed that two men had been brought in for questioning, but said that they had not yet been charged. They also said that the reward fund had led to a flurry of tips and leads. The two men were subsequently identified as 21-year-old Jamaican-born Kirk Mundy and 17-year-old Justice Smith. At the time of his arrest, Kirk was on bail for conspiring to rob a bank in November of 1995. The former friend of Kirk, who had been arrested alongside him for the botched robbery, told the Toronto Sun that Kirk wasn't a good person and he had been attempting to avoid him. Quote, "He acts like he's tougher than everyone," he said. Kirk's brother, Chris, spoke with the Sun after the arrests and said that if his brother was involved in Rebecca's murder, then he would want nothing to do with him, describing the crime as wicked. Justice had grown up on Deepdale Road in an area north of Bermuda known as the Back of Town. It's an area where very few tourists frequent unless they're looking to score drugs. The details of the arrests made their way to Belleville, where David said he hopes that police have the right guys. Quote, "It will be interesting to see if it's good, hard, solid evidence. Eventually, the clincher will be the DNA," he said. He also added that he would like to travel back to Bermuda to attend the trial of his daughter's killers. The next day, Justice was charged with premeditated murder and Kirk was charged with being an accessory to murder. Juveniles in the Bermudian system are those under 16 years old, meaning that Justice would be tried in adult court. And in Bermuda, premeditated murder, which is the equivalent to first-degree murder, could carry a death sentence. The two men appeared in court and were ordered to be held in custody while awaiting trial. The following month, trial proceedings were stalled as prosecutors were still waiting for the DNA evidence, which was apparently being held in a lab in Ottawa. According to prosecutors, this DNA would be the smoking gun to prove that Justice and Kirk were the killers. It wasn't even noticed that the DNA had not yet been returned until Justice's defense lawyers questioned why the investigation was progressing so slowly. Quote, "It's been almost 2 months since my client was charged and I don't want to have to return to court again in vain," said Elizabeth Christopher. Despite the lack of physical evidence, Senior Crown Attorney Elliot stated that they were ready to proceed with the preliminary hearing. In mid-October, as the defense and prosecution were preparing for the preliminary hearing to determine whether there was enough evidence against the defendants, Kirk pleaded guilty to being an accessory to the murder of Rebecca in return for his testimony against Justice during his murder trial. He was subsequently sentenced to just 5 years in prison. When he appeared in court, Kirk claimed that as they were riding on the motorcycle, Rebecca began to fondle him and whisper that she wanted to have sex with him. He said that they drove to a park and had consensual sex. Afterwards, he claimed that he went to the water to wash himself. He said that while here, he heard Rebecca scream no. He said that when he rushed back to where Rebecca was, he said it looked as though Justice was punching her in the face. But moments later, he noticed blood spurting out from her neck. The two men then jumped on the motorcycle and Justice threw the knife into the ocean. Kirk remained calm throughout the appearance and muttered, "I'm sorry," before he was handed the 5-year sentence. The extremely lenient sentence horrified Rebecca's family, who said they felt as though they had been cheated and burned. Her brother, Matt, said that the testimony had angered him because what Kirk was saying was obviously fabricated.
"Why would they do that? And I was outraged. I was really, really, really outraged that it could have happened. I couldn't understand why it could possibly be done when the evidence, the DNA examination, had not been completed by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which was their duty to do.
I couldn't believe the fact that they were doing it because there was no DNA. I mean, you got one criminal's word against the other criminal's word, and they're going to sell their mother to save their life."
The following week, Justice appeared in court for a closed preliminary hearing and claimed that it was Kirk who had killed Rebecca. Quote, "Fly Mundy is a liar and a coward. It is he who raped and killed the girl. Now he and the police are trying to put it on me, and that's not right," he said. Nevertheless, Justice was ordered to stand trial before the Bermudian Supreme Court. Hey Hey guys, as you know, I'm always on the hunt for awesome podcasts to listen to, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about a show that I'm excited about. If you're a fan of morbidology, then I think Housewives of True Crime will be right up your alley. Each week, sisters Gretchen and Tabitha sit down and tell each other a true crime story, while the other asks the questions that everybody wants to know, real time. If you like the show, make sure to check out their premium channel on Himalaya, where you can find episodes ad-free and 24 hours early, as well as exclusive content and a members-only community group where you can chat with the hosts. Simply download the Himalaya app, search Housewives of True Crime, and enter promo code Housewives for your first month absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go and check out Housewives of True Crime. I love the show, and I think that you will too. Justice pleaded not guilty, and his lawyer stated that they were still waiting for the results of the DNA testing. Over the forthcoming months, the trial kept getting pushed back and back. In January of 1998, an additional murder charge against Kirk was filed. While prosecutors didn't elaborate on why the charges were filed, it was alleged that DNA had come back from Canada and presumably implicated Kirk in the murder. Now, it was up to Supreme Court Judge Richard Grund to decide whether Kirk too should face trial on premeditated murder charges. Solicitor General William Pierce, who was one of Bermuda's top prosecutors, defended the decision, urging the judge to not let Kirk get away with murder. Kirk's lawyer, Saul Frumkin, however, said that it was illegal to reinstate the murder charges using the same set of facts. He stated that Kirk had been guaranteed the lesser charge after he agreed to testify against Justice. Supreme Court Judge Richard Grund ruled that Kirk could be tried for the murder of Rebecca and filed a voluntary bill allowing him to bypass the plea bargain he had already made. Kirk was subsequently arraigned on the murder charge. Both he and Justice appeared in court once again, and Justice pleaded not guilty, while Kirk asked the judge to dismiss the case. Kirk's lawyer, Saul Frumkin, argued that prosecutors had gone to four pathologists before using the opinion of a fifth to support their claims that Kirk had killed Rebecca. Quote, "They finally got one they liked. It's scandalous the way this case has been handled," he said. Shortly thereafter, the Bermudan Court of Appeals overturned the judge's ruling that Kirk should face murder charges. They gave no reason for the decision. This decision meant the suspension of both trials until the Attorney General appeals the ruling in Britain's Privy Council. In July, the Supreme Court for British Territories rejected the request to retry Kirk, meaning that he would testify against Justice, serve his 5-year sentence, and then be a free man. Finally, in November of 1998, Justice Smith was sent to trial. David and Cindy flew to Bermuda so they could attend each day. They were determined to get justice for Rebecca since they had received no justice with Kirk's pitiful sentence.
I wanted to see the thing get over with, but of course what I wanted was a conviction. They were very confident that they were going to get a conviction on this.
Justice's parents had hired John Perry, a British lawyer, to defend their son, while Solicitor General of Bermuda William Pierce and his co-counsel Sandra Backus would be prosecuting the case. During the opening statements, Solicitor General William Pierce told the silent courtroom how Rebecca had been brutally assaulted, tortured, and then stabbed 16 times before being left to die in a desolate patch of woodland just off a dirt track. Pierce described how Rebecca was held down before being stabbed to death. One of the first witnesses to testify was Sion Smith, who was not related to Justice. He described to the court how he had seen Kirk following Rebecca's murder, yet said he saw no blood on Kirk, which would suggest that he had been involved in a brutal murder. While he was testifying, Justice became furious and stood up from his defense table and shouted "liar" across the room at Sion. According to Sion, he and his cousin had been driving home from a nightclub in the early morning hours of the 3rd of July 1996 when their car broke down. He described how Kirk, who was alone on his motorcycle, pulled up alongside him and asked if he needed some help. Refuting his statement, Justice's lawyer, John Perry, suggested that Sion had made this sighting up because he was afraid of Kirk, who had a bad reputation around Bermuda. Sion confessed that he was afraid of retribution, which is why he didn't initially come forward to tell police that he had seen Kirk that night. Dana Rollins, who was one of the men who found Rebecca's body, described how he had been working as a DJ in a local nightclub. Following his shift, he and several friends went bar hopping, and on their way home, they found Rebecca. He described how Rebecca was only wearing a torn shirt, which was completely saturated in blood.
I had touched her wrist to take her pulse and didn't feel anything. And as I looked into her eyes, I could see no movement. Pupils were fixed and dilated.
He said he lifted her wrist and could feel a pulse. He asked her if she could hear him. Rebecca turned her head but was unable to reply. Dana described how when Rebecca turned to face him, he noticed that there was a tear in her eye and a large gash to her throat. It was evident that she had been attacked, and the men climbed back into the car and sped off to a payphone to call for help. He confessed that he was too afraid to stay with Rebecca and too afraid to go and get help alone. Dana described how when he rushed back to Rebecca after calling for help, he checked her pulse once again and it was gone. Rebecca was dead. He said he placed a towel over her body and waited for an ambulance, knowing that it was already too late for her. Dr. Michael Baden, director of Forensic Science Services for New York State Police, took to the stand to describe Rebecca's injuries.
There were about 16 stab wounds, about 5 stab wounds that went into vital organs, cut the jugular vein, and about 19 superficial cut wounds, mostly on the neck area and the head.
He stated that he had identified 40 separate injuries on Rebecca's body, which included 16 stab wounds, as well as superficial cuts and blunt force injuries. The fatal injuries included one in the back that went into Rebecca's ribs and punctured her lungs, as well as a stab wound which injured Rebecca's heart. 2 other wounds on the front of Rebecca's body punctured her right lung and one injured the left. He testified that before receiving the fatal stab wounds, Rebecca had received superficial wounds that he equated to torture. These stab wounds weren't to kill her, but to hurt her.
They were meant to get her to cooperate, to do things that she didn't want to do during the sexual attack. It was extremely painful and extremely both physically and emotionally painful.
He also described how the superficial wounds had been inflicted while Rebecca was sitting on the ground with her killer standing above her. He estimated that it probably took Rebecca around 30 minutes to die. Dr. Michael Baden also theorized that due to the lack of wounds on Rebecca's hands, she had most likely had her hands tied behind her back or held behind her back, unable to defend herself. He also suggested that due to bruising on her shoulders and the superficial wounds to her neck and head, it was probable that 2 people were involved in her murder. Quote, she had to be held still in a seated position, her arms held by 2 hands, her head by one hand and the cuts made by one.
There are grab marks on both upper arms, which are typical if somebody is grabbing a body to lift them up. There's also smear marks on the ankles, which also means contact between hands of another person and the ankles. She was carried over to the middle of the roadway and left there. There was a horrible murder here with, in my opinion, 2 people involved.
When photographs of Rebecca's slain body were shown, one juror began to weep while others refused to look. The description of Rebecca's murder was disturbing enough. They couldn't bring themselves to look at the photographs as well. During cross-examination, it was uncovered that only DNA from Kirk Mundy was found inside Rebecca.
Did they come back with Justice Smith's DNA?
Nope.
They came back with Kirk Mundy's. Kirk Mundy outsmarted the Attorney General and the police, and probably his lawyer, because they all believed the cockamamie story came up with. Why didn't they just wait?
Dr. Michael Baden confirmed that there was no semen, no hairs, no fibers, and no blood that could connect Justice Smith to the murder. With this revelation, Kirk's own defense lawyer said that the deal his client made may have been premature. Dr. James Johnson, the pathologist who had conducted Rebecca's autopsy, appeared as a prosecution witness. However, his statements came across as stronger for the defense. He counteracted Dr. Michael Baden's theory that two people were involved in Rebecca's murder and claimed that there was a single killer. The murder weapon, according to Dr. James Johnson, was a knife around 10 centimeters long with a 1.2 centimeter wide blade. Shortly after the autopsy, Police Inspector Howard Cutts had showed Dr. James Johnson a knife that was found in the water near the crime scene to ask him whether he thought it may have been the murder weapon. Dr. James Johnson said no because it had a 1.5 centimeter wide blade and had crustaceans and rust on the blade and handle, indicating it had been in the water for some time. Nevertheless, the prosecution presented this knife as evidence, stating that it was the murder weapon. Defense lawyer John Perry seized on the suggestion that the knife found in the water was not the murder weapon and asked Dr. James Johnson to go over each wound inflicted on Rebecca and point out which wounds were smaller than the blade the prosecution claimed was the murder weapon. In total, there were 12 wounds that were smaller than the blade. Quote, "That's the end of their bloody case. They can't prove the knife was the murder weapon," Perry muttered under his breath. The following day, however, Miami police analyst Robert Hart testified that the knife found in the water was the same size and shape as the others in a box of steak knives found in Justice's home. U.S. forensic examiner Michael Kelly also testified that the knife found in the water matched cuts to Rebecca's blood-stained shirt. When Jasmine testified, she recollected how their evening started out just like any other evening. She and Rebecca had met their friends at the pub and went to a friend's house before trying to get a taxi back home. She said that while they were standing outside and waiting for the taxi, Dean Lottimore stopped and asked them if they needed a lift. Moments later, another motorcycle carrying two men drove by, turned around, and then came back and stopped. Jasmine said that the two men on this motorcycle were Kirk and Justice. Jasmine testified that Rebecca had hugged one of the men and showed him her necklace. The two men had asked the girls if they wanted a ride, to which they agreed.
Becky was talking to me about my necklace that I'd given her. He was admiring the necklace and asked what we were doing. And I said that we were waiting for our cab. And he suggested that we go on the bike with them. I said that we couldn't because we didn't have a helmet and I didn't want to get in trouble. I just wanted to get back. And I said, okay, you get on that bike and I'll go on this one, because I was bigger than she was. And there was two of them and there was one on the other bike.
Jasmine jumped on the back of Dean's motorcycle while Rebecca sandwiched herself in between Justice and Kirk. Dean testified that the other motorcycle sped off and he lost sight of them. He said that he subsequently drove to Jasmine's house and dropped her home. He said that when they arrived, Jasmine became worried when she realized that Rebecca wasn't there. Quote, "Jasmine looked frightened to me. I was trying to calm her down," he said.
She started to kind of panic, like, because we would have thought she would have beat us to the house.
Jasmine and her father set out to look for Rebecca while Dean drove home. On the way home, he drove down Ferry Road. Here, he said he spotted four people gathered at the side of the road and saw that they were surrounding Rebecca, lifeless on the ground.
Finally, I'm getting this kind of thing off my chest. Like, it's been a burden to me for a long time. It's always a memory to me, you know? It's always a memory to me.
When the prosecution asked Dean if he knew the two men that had picked Rebecca up on their motorcycle, he said, quote, "Yeah, the driver was Kirk Mundy and the passenger was Justice Smith."
I got tired of hearing all these threats. And anyway, I saw her to stand strong and just go through with it. Go for it, because it's not right what they done. That's just wrong.
A security officer also testified that he had seen Kirk and Justice shortly after Rebecca's murder. Rick Means told the court that when he identified Rebecca's body, he needed to take a second look because he couldn't quite believe that it was her, even though deep down he knew it was.
They unzipped the body bag and And Becky was in it. I can't describe what I seen, other than I seen that sweet little girl that I had dropped off the night before in that body bag.
Rick's voice quivered as he told the court that he and Jasmine had gone out searching for Rebecca but were unsuccessful in finding her. He said that around 7 a.m, he got into his car to cover more ground. He said that he hadn't been out for 5 minutes when police called him and asked him to come down to the station. He said they couldn't tell him why, but he thought that maybe Rebecca had been raped. Almost as soon as he hung up the phone, he heard the news on the radio that a body had been found. As the prosecution was wrapping up their evidence, the defence asked Supreme Court Judge Vincent Mirbox to dismiss the charges against Justice, stating that there was absolutely no evidence which could connect him to Rebecca's murder. Sadly, the judge agreed. Quote, "There is no evidence of his blood, his semen, bits of his flesh at the crime scene. If you can show to this court that the evidence is before the court, then please do that," he said. Solicitor General William Pierce made the point that circumstantial evidence is relied upon in numerous murder cases and that there was enough evidence for the jury to reach a decision. He reminded the judge that in Bermuda law, it was not necessary to identify the principal offender in a murder case because those who aid and abet are principal offenders. Ultimately, Judge Vincent Mirbox ruled that there was not enough evidence against Justice Smith and he threw out the case. He noted that the only physical evidence in the case pointed towards Kirk Mundy. A juror burst into tears while Jasmine stood up in court and shouted. Justice's friends cheered as he was escorted out of court, and Jasmine's father, Rick, began arguing with Justice's defense lawyer. Cindy ran out of the courtroom while David didn't move, his face frozen in disbelief.
It was kind of a shock. He said that the prosecution did not provide sufficient evidence that Justice Smith was even at the crime scene. Somebody in the prosecution's team started crying, and we were all just, we couldn't believe it.
It was like a stab to your heart. I was like, I can't believe that. What does that mean?
Smith walked away. Smith just walked out the door.
Justice left the courthouse after just 2 years in jail and went home a free man. William Pierce, the lead prosecutor, subsequently appealed the verdict. He argued that there was enough evidence against Justice and that Judge Vincent Mirbox failed to take into account the circumstantial evidence against him. Bermuda's appeal court ordered a new trial for Justice Smith. However, shortly thereafter, the decision for a retrial was appealed at Britain's Privy Council, which acts as Bermuda's highest court. They ruled that Justice could not be tried a second time on the same charge. Their decision was final and there would be no further appeal. The outcome was both a tragedy and a travesty. In all likelihood, one or both men were involved in Rebecca's murder, yet neither were convicted of her murder due to a hasty investigation, a bad plea bargain, double jeopardy, and a lack of physical evidence against one of the men. The bungling of the case could mean one of two things. The first is that an innocent man may have been railroaded by police in a desperate attempt to identify Rebecca's killer. Investigators were so ready to accept the testimony of Kirk, a known criminal who claimed he had consensual sex with Rebecca and that she was killed by Justice. Or it could mean that Justice was guilty, but investigators and the prosecution didn't do a good enough job. What can be said for sure, however, is that it was a horrific error for the Attorney General in striking a deal with Kirk Mundy before DNA evidence had been returned. By all forensic evidence, Kirk was guilty, but due to double jeopardy, it was too late to charge him with murder.
Everything failed. Everything failed. I blame nobody. Nobody set about to wreck this case. But this was a failure of the entire Bermuda criminal justice process from beginning to end.
An inquiry into the handling of the case uncovered serious shortcomings in the Bermuda justice system. They heard of behind-the-scenes deals being offered, bad practices, and inappropriate behaviour by both police and legal officials. Mark Telemach, a senior defence lawyer, said that police officers were often suggesting suspects plead guilty to a lesser charge without properly investigating the crime. They are so eager to get any kind of confession that they forfeit uncovering the truth. Crown Counsel Kamisi Tonokbu said that some officers were inexperienced and lacked commitment to the force. In 2002, Justice Smith was charged with the assault of two women with a knife. He was sentenced to 10 months. However, the judge subsequently released Justice after giving him credit for time served since his arrest. 2 years later, Kirkmundy told Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper that he thinks about Rebecca's murder all of the time. He expressed sympathy for her family, but stopped short of admitting his guilt. Cindy responded by saying, quote, "I don't know what to make of it. My daughter's dead. I don't care what he's saying now. Watch your actions when you do them. Don't take someone's life or be there when something's happening like that." Following his release from prison, Kirk was deported to Jamaica. Over the forthcoming years, Rebecca's family desperately sought justice for their daughter. They attempted to have the case reopened several times before in 2008, David announced with a heavy heart that he could no longer finance his battle to get the Bermuda legal system to bring her killers to justice. Quote, "If you don't stand up and say something, you failed in my opinion. Nothing's going to bring Becky back to us, but the sad thing is what's happened to us has happened before and will happen again."
I just don't want to feel the pain that I feel. I tried standing in front of a train, but chickened out. I've had dark moments. Because she's dead. And I'm here.
It's easy for people to say, get over it and move on. Tell that to Becky's parents. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
With nobody ever held responsible for Rebecca Middleton's murder, her family's nightmare will continue. They deserve more. Every single day, her family attended trial, hoping and fully expecting justice to be served. On the picturesque island of Bermuda, men greet one another with a simple fist bump while they greet women by tipping their hat and saying good morning. To those visiting, it would look like they've known each other for years, but that's just how things are in this beautiful British colony. It's easy to lose big city inhibitions while visiting, and in the aftermath of Rebecca Middleton's murder, it was this sense of community that made the entire island feel guilt. It left behind a scar that never really healed. Not only was the murder itself disturbing, but the manner in which the case was investigated.
She was there to have fun, have a good time, and go home and tell everybody about the great time she had in Bermuda. But instead, she never made it home. I thought maybe I could have saved her. And it's haunted me ever since. I named my daughter Rebecca because I said to myself, I connected with her that night and I felt really bad that I couldn't save her. And I had said to her and promised myself that if I ever had a daughter, your memory and your name would live on.
Each year, Rebecca's family still celebrate her birthday. While not here in person, in small ways, Rebecca still lives on. Her brother gave his daughter the middle name Rebecca. Jasmine also gave her own daughter the middle name Rebecca, while Dana Rollins, the man who found Rebecca and testified at trial, named his daughter Becky. Scholarships in both Belleville and Bermuda were named in Rebecca's memory. Her family still hold on to the belief that one day, maybe not in their lifetime, justice will come. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. Morbidology's first exclusive episode will be uploaded to Patreon and Himalaya Plus this week, so please check that out if you're interested in supporting the show that way. I'd also like to thank everybody who has taken the time to leave a positive review or rating on iTunes or wherever else you listen, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.